when to follow a tradition and when to reject it. As Christians, where's our freedom to do as we please? And when should we persevere out of love? And does gathering with the family for a Christmas dinner really have anything to do with Jesus anyhow? Earlier in December, Jill Stark wrote this in The Age, which captures, I think, the dilemma. She wrote, "Christmas is sold as a time of togetherness." But she goes on to write, "After many years of gratefully being an orphan guest at other people's family festivities, I've realised that isn't actually how I want to spend the day. This year," she wrote, "I plan to start my own traditions, starting with an early morning hike in nature." Doesn't that sound nice? I wonder if you resonate with Jill's feeling. That's not how I want to spend the day. I think she's right that the Christmas tradition of gathering with others to share a meal is expected on such a wide scale in Australia that it's actually virtually obligatory. You might feel obliged to gather even if you don't have someone you'd like to gather with, purely so you're not missing out. And the tension I guess I'm naming is that the tradition may not be serving us. Despite the pitch of happy family reunions, gushing with love and laughter and delight, the lived experience, even in the best of families, sometimes leaves us wondering, is gathering for Christmas dinner really worth the trouble? And the stakes, I think, are even higher for those who are not literally orphaned, but rather have strained family situations, where further damage to already fragile relationships is almost certain. The cost of gathering to eat a meal at Christmas may simply be too high a price to pay. Doesn't the Bible teach better a dry crust with peace than a house full of feasting with strife? Of course, some are powerless over the troubles at Christmas dinner. If you live with the gut-wrenching experience of having a loved one who has violent dementia or mental illness or drug addiction or some other condition, you may know the pain which promises to derail any gathering you might plan. The Bible reading said, "No one should seek their own good but the good of others." But which others? I mean, do you prioritise the troubled relative or the children, the grandchildren, the in-laws that might not come? Of course, not all of us are dreading the Christmas meal, but it doesn't mean it's easy. More than one family jokes that they're only going to make it through with the help of some alcohol. One statistic I read suggested that Australians will spend more than $500 million on getting jolly with beverages between Christmas and New Year. So the big question is the traditional Christmas meal really a good thing? I mean, what does the Lord of Life think as he watches us spending more on alcohol than in care of the poor and hungry, so we can go peace-faking our way through a dinner every year in honour of him, the Prince of Peace? As the passage today has reminded us, not everything is beneficial or constructive. And as I read Jill's plan to withdraw by herself to a morning hike in nature, I found myself thinking of Jesus, who skipped brunch, went off to a solitary place to pray, to get reconnected with the priorities for his life. What are the principles we should use to work out what a Christ-like response to this feasting tradition should look like? Of course, by now, some of you will be thinking, that's all very sad, but my Christmas gathering isn't actually like that. We like each other. It's relaxed. It's something I look forward to. And on the whole, I'm with you in that. My family isn't perfect, but there's a lot to be thankful for. And yet still, I'm sometimes wearied by the tradition of the traditional Christmas meal, hosts and cooks, attempting to please everyone in every way, as our reading said, and serving up show-stopping perfection. It's a temptation I've struggled with. And in truth, sometimes my culinary showstopper has come at great relational cost, either because I spent more time on the showstopper than actually relating with the people that I was wanting to serve it to, or sometimes because somehow it all ends up in tears. Someone ate the bit that's supposed to go on the top, or, you know, something happened. It wasn't Tavis, I'm sure. I'm sure no one in my family would do that. But I'm also sometimes saddened because as loved ones, we sometimes wrestle our way through the day, attempting to overlook all the ways that we inadvertently leave each other feeling inadequate or judged, misunderstood, just a bit lonely. Because we don't really know each other as well as any of us wish. And I can't help but compare even the best family gathering to a better dream. Of course, there's nothing intrinsically Christian about gathering to overeat. The Apostle James warns us, actually, if we are to be gluttonous about this. You've lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. Well, you've fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. And if we add to that consideration of the inevitable excess and waste that participating in a typical Australian Christmas lunch would involve, I think it poses a real question of conscience for Christian people. By now you might be thinking, hold up. I think the Christmas ham might be on the line here. And I can hear the theologians ticking along and thinking, hang on, I want to argue with you here. Jesus may not have instituted an annual Christmas feast in his name, but he was no killjoy. Doesn't the Bible say that the Son of Man came eating and drinking? Wasn't it Jesus, you might argue, who turned water into wine at a feast? And doesn't the Apostle Paul, even in our reading today, say, follow the example of Christ? Surely, we might argue, if Jesus saw feasting as a ministry, how much more should we? I mean, if Jesus celebrated the Passover, which was like a shadow of the victory he came to win, how much more should we feast in celebration of the incarnation? Christmas is the moment where the tables turned in the battle against sin and death as God unveils his plan to rescue the whole earth. Surely that warrants a bit of feasting and celebration, surely. I'm not seeing any nods. There's some nods. Well, I think there is a genuine dilemma in this. What is the right thing for Christians to do about the traditional Christmas dinner gathering? Is it right to join the tradition, or does authentic discipleship call us to do something more godly with the day? Or is there like a third possibility, like a way of embracing this tradition but redeeming it somehow? Ultimately, the question of each person's participation in the tradition of a Christmas dinner, I think, comes down to a question of conscience under God. There's not a single verse in the Bible which will instruct us whether we should go to Christmas dinner or not. So this is the sort of discernment where we're looking for wisdom principles to guide us. And this is where we're well served by the reading we heard this morning from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. To be clear, Paul isn't writing to the Corinthians about whether or not they should gather for a Christmas dinner. But he is seeking to address a question about whether believers can in good conscience gather for a meal with unbelievers. And if they do, what rules would they use to decide whether what to eat or what to refuse at the meal at such a cross-cultural gathering? And in these few pithy verses, I think Paul gives us a wealth of principles that will lead us to developing a biblically informed conscience which can result in wise living. Today I want to highlight just three. And the first is in verse 31. Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. This verse is the climax or controlling verse of Paul's advice in this section, and it speaks to our underlying motives. Who are we seeking glory for in how we decide whether or not to join a Christmas dinner gathering, and how we'll conduct ourselves in the way we join once we're there? So that's the first principle. I think the second principle is that God is glorified when we seek the good of others. In verse 24, no one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Verse 29, I'm referring to the other person's conscience, not yours. Verse 32, don't cause anyone to stumble. Verse 33, I'm not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. How does the way that you engage in Christmas lead others that they may be saved? It's a big bar. Of all the things Jesus taught, I wonder what these two principles are reminding you of. For me, what comes to mind is Jesus' teaching that the greatest and first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. And the second is like it, love your neighbour as yourself. So these two principles, love God, love others. Can you see how Paul is actually stepping his reader through application of the two great commandments in how you would live them out in a real life conscience decision? Something that stands out to me is that a well-developed, biblically informed conscience under God actually leads to great freedom of conscience. We have liberty under God. I don't think that's what people think when they think about Christian discipleship or Christians in the world. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. It's a quote from Psalm 24, and these are the words that Jewish people often used as a meal blessing in Paul's day, or so I'm told. And Paul quotes this to remind those who are reading them that when you've got solid biblical foundations, you can eat or drink whatever is put before you in good conscience. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, provided that what you do, you are doing for the glory of God. So the question isn't, should I feast or should I not feast? The question is, how will our interactions and our contributions in whatever we do this Christmas glorify God and serve others? So we have liberty to enjoy a good feast if we want, unless by participating in the meal you will cause others to stumble. Jesus himself said, it'd be better to tie a millstone around your neck and throw yourself into the sea than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. So a conscience developed under God with love of neighbour in mind will lead to freedom limited by love. In matters of conscience, the Christian person aims to both glorify God and seek the good of others. And so let me ask you, in what ways are your plans and expectations about gathering for Christmas this year, for a meal or not, endorsed or confronted by these principles? What do you sense the Lord is saying to your conscience? As the scripture says today, if you hear his voice. And if you'd like someone to pray with or for you after the service, there's no judgment here. We've all had terrible and wonderful Christmases, and so I invite you to come forward at the end and there'll be people who can pray with you. So let me finish by sharing the third principle for discerning matters of conscience. And this, I think, comes back to something I said earlier. I can't help but compare even the best family gathering to a better dream. The thing is, it doesn't actually matter whether you're anticipating the joy of gathering with loved ones and fantastic food, or whether you're anticipating the joy of missing out. Chances are, whatever you do, it won't be perfect. It's a right desire, though, that we have to gather with others, to feast and to celebrate what God's done. But if we're trying to satisfy that right desire through Christmas dinner, we're looking in all the wrong places for joy. The truth is, there's no amount of sumptuous turkey or perfect pavlova or any other special food, even the joy of gathering with people who love each other, which can ever satisfy that deep yearning. The third principle in this diagnostic tool reminds us that to imagine that providing the appearance of the perfect Christmas meal will somehow make atonement for everything that's wrong in the world is both naive and probably a form of idolatry. So this Christmas, whether you plan to feast or fast, to gather with others or to take off into the bush, whether you find it joyful or disappointing or downright painful, I want to encourage you to keep yearning. Keep longing for a better dream, Jesus' promise of a better feast. The prophet Isaiah spoke of that better dream when he recorded this promise. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all the peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, the Lord will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces, and he will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. Over the coming days, whether you gather with others to eat and drink or whatever you do, let me encourage you to engage with liberty, to honour and glorify God, with limits, showing love to others and not causing anyone to stumble, and with longing, as you remember to yearn for the better feast, which is yet to come when the Lord returns. Come, Lord Jesus.